Good afternoon, everyone. Again, this is Kurt Larson from the California Comprehensive Center. On behalf of Center and the California Department of Education, I welcome you today for the webinar about the implications of federal Title I regulations on public school choice and supplemental educational services. Before we get started, I would like to cover some housekeeping details. So during the webinar today, your comments, concerns, questions are welcomed at any time during the webinar in the lower left area of the chat room. Please make sure that you're addressing the main room. So under the area that says 2, be sure it says main room. Type your message or comment or question and hit return. If you need technical support during the event, you're welcome to text chat me. I'm Kay Larson at the very top. So if you click on my name under the list of participants, you can text chat me for help. I'd also like to first collect some data today. So we'd like to find out who's participating with us. So if you're on the webinar, please enter the LE name, the participant name and title, and the participant email addresses. Now, if you're in a room with quite a few number of people, just enter one contact person and say, please contact us for the full list of attendees. But this is a way for CDE to collect the names of people attending today in case we want to do some follow-up. So please go ahead and do that. We're going to have you submit those responses and then move on with our presentation. Give you about 30 more seconds. I'd also like to say that there's some static on the line, so if we're moving phones around, or if you're not speaking, please mute your phone with *6. All right, I'm going to go ahead and move on in the presentation. I would now like to introduce Maria Reyes, Administrator of the School Support and Title I Basic Office at CDE. Maria, in the room?
I am. Thank you very much, Kurt. And thank you, everybody, for joining us this afternoon for this session. This session is being presented to you jointly by the California Department of Education, the State FES Work Group, and technical assistance from the California Comprehensive Center. I just want to mention briefly that the FES Work Group are 30 LEAs that have been working with us collaboratively for about a year and a half. And you're going to be, the focus of that work group is FES implementation statewide, and you're going to be personally experiencing the work of this FES Work Group when we talk about upcoming webinars later on in the presentation. But for now, it's my pleasure to present to you the folks who are going to be joining us today. Becky Robinson, Program Specialist from Los Angeles Unified, Jim Pfaff from Modesto City Elementary School District, Amby Clay from Oakland Unified, and staff from here from the California Department of Education, Judy Brown, and Lana Joe, two consultants in our office. Let's move to slide 5. The focus of today's presentation is going to be the new requirements from the Title I FES, from the Title I federal regulations that were released recently. And we're going to be talking about some of those new requirements, such as parent notification for choice in SES, local educational educational agency, web posting of choice and SES information, funding for choice and SES, allowable charges for parent outreach and assistance, reallocation requirements of the unspent funds from the 20% obligation, and implementation timeline. In slide six, we're sort of recapping the genesis of these regulations. They became effective November 28, 2008, and the implementation requirements are, we do expect LEAs to be meeting these requirements in 2009-10 school year. The U.S. Department of Ed issued new guidance along with the regulations, or shortly after the regulations, in January 2009 on both choice and SES. You, as you can see on the slide, the all these resources are links to those documents that I just mentioned. In addition to the this slide contains web links to those resources. Now I would like to have Becky take us through the next few slides.
Just before you get started, Becky, I do hear some echoing in our presentation. So I want to make sure that our co-presenters are all muted unless they're speaking. We may be getting feedback, so that would be just a star six. When you want to unmute, you would use star six again. Interruption.
Okay, and now if we can look at slide seven, please, Kurt. Okay, on slide seven, we're talking about parent notification. And the new regulations clearly say that LEAs notify parents of eligible students of the availability of choice sufficiently in advance of, but no later than 14 calendar days before the first day of the school year, following the school year in which the LEA administered the assessments that resulted in the school being identified for program improvement. An LEA should offer choice as early as possible so that parents may consider their choice options well in advance of the start of the school year. In the case of year-round schools, public school choice be offered sufficiently in advance of, but no later than 14 calendar days before the beginning of the school year, as that term is defined by the State Department of Education Agency, or the LEA. The CDE is currently discussing the option of seeking a federal waiver on the 14-day requirement. As it stands right now, California will not be able to meet this requirement for newly identified PI schools. You may want to review the letter from Secretary Duncan about his and other changes to NCLB at the link identified on the slide. And Maria, will you please give us an update on the status of the CDE's waiver application on the 14-day requirement for choice parent notification? Maria?
Yes, Becky. As Becky indicated, we are considering right now seeking a waiver, which is now allowed, on the 14-day requirement. It's only a one-year requirement, and we already know that we won't be able to meet it this year and probably not likely in the near future. So just because of the way the AYP data come in to the State Department of Education. So now we really are back to, as soon as the release of the AYP data, that's when you, the LEAs, need to notify parents. We'll be talking a little bit more, I think, about other ways that you can still meet the intent of the law here, but that's the status for now.
Thank you, Maria. And now if we look at slide, we're talking about parent notification for SES. And the new requirements for SES parent notification include providing an explanation of the benefits of receiving SES, using a clear, concise notification to parents, which is distinguishable from other information, and indicating providers who are able to serve students with disabilities and or English learners. In the next few slides, we will provide some specifics on each of the three requirements stated in slide eight. Staff at CDE will shortly be reviewing the parent notification letters and recommending language in the templates to meet these new requirements. The parent notification templates are currently available at the two SES websites, which are listed on slide 33. And on slide nine, there are some examples of the SES benefits. What are the benefits of receiving SES? An LEA has discretion in determining what information regarding the benefits of SES to include in its notice to parents. They can be benefits substantiated by research conducted by the Education Department or by states, LEAs, or other entities related to improving student academic proficiency. In addition, an LEA's notice could include, for example, the fact that SES are free tutoring that can be tailored to the particular academic needs of each participating student, are available at no cost to parents, and make productive use of a student out of school time in a safe environment. Furthermore, an LEA could note that SES allows parents to select the approved provider of their choice that best meets their child's academic needs. Nyambi Clay will discuss further notification requirements on the slides. Nyambi?
Thank you, Becky. So on slide 10, it discusses parent notification and what it means to be clear and concise. And basically what you want to do is make sure that the notice is clear and concise, that uses terms that parents can easily understand, terms such as free tutoring in addition to saying supplemental educational services. You also want to include other key phrases that convey the benefits of SES, such as help your child succeed in school. Basically, you want to make sure that it's parent-friendly and that you're avoiding legal and professional educational terms. The notice should be in simple, plain language, and if it should be translated into multiple languages. Actually, in fact, in California, if you have more than 15% of your student population that speaks a certain language, you must translate your parent literature. Slide 11 discusses how the notification needs to be clearly distinguishable. And what does it mean for a parent notification to be clearly distinguishable? It basically means that the SES notice should be clearly distinguishable from other school improvement information. So you can send it out with other school improvement information, but the notice should be distinguishable from that other information. You also can send it out separately, but you're not required to send out the SES notification separately. If you do send it out with other information on program improvement, you should use strategies so that parents can easily recognize it from other information, such as you might want to print it on really bright colored paper and use large, bold fonts so that parents are more likely to read it. Right now, we have a polling activity for you. And basically, we want to know, does your LEA send the SES parent notification in a separate mailing? If you do, use your checkbox and mark check. And if you don't, use the X for it.
All right. So if you look at the participant list to the left of Nyambi's picture, you'll see underneath that is a check, an X, and a hand. Use check for yes, X for no, and we'll see what our numbers are. So I do see numbers changing. Folks are finding the yes, no buttons now. So I'll give them a few more seconds. So it looks like we have 33 yeses and 10 noes.
Thanks.
So on slide, should I move on? Are we ready?
Yes, we'll move on.
Okay. On slide 12, the other thing that your parent notification must include is information about which providers serve students with disabilities and or English language learners. The CDE actually collects this information through the request for application process, the RFA process, and they post this information on the web with the list of providers. So the link that you see there on the slide, you can access that link to get the information about your providers, which ones serve students with disabilities and English language learners. And don't forget, if you download this presentation, you can actually just click right on the link and it will take you directly to the web page.
Right. We're going to move on to a question answer pause session. So, ladies and gentlemen, our registration process, we did receive your questions and concerns about both choice and SES. and CDE has prepared some answers for that. I don't know that we had any answers come in the chat area prior to this now during this presentation, but go ahead and submit your answers at any time in the left-hand chat area. And CDE, do we have any?
Yes, we do, Kurt. We have a few that were submitted earlier, and we can go over those. But we are asking them, right, to the participants to go ahead and submit their questions, and we'll do our best to answer those as they as we see them on the screen here. One of the questions that was submitted had to do with public school choice, and the question was, what is the law that states school districts need to pay for transportation for students who go to a charter school as their public school choice? A charter school within an LEA can be offered as the school of choice, and the LEA must pay for transportation for those students who are transferring to the charter under NCLB. So the trigger, obviously, is that the student is coming from a program improvement school and wants to transfer to a charter within the LEA. Charter schools that fall within the boundaries of an LEA but are not authorized by the LEA may also be included as transfer options. In other words, in this case, the charter is an independent charter, meaning another LEA. The public school options may be, but are not required to be, public schools that operate Title I programs. So the choice transfer falls under NCLB. It is from, in general, a program improvement school to a non-program improvement school.
The next question related to public school choice, it was, what do you think about sending these notices to parents at the end of this school year rather than sending them just before school starts in the fall? The new Title I regulations require LEAs notify parents that their child is eligible for public school choice sufficiently in advance, but no later than 14 calendar days before the start of the school year for which public school choice being offered. However, California, as Maria indicated, California will not be able to implement the 14-day requirement, and we are seeking a waiver in that regard. As we have always encouraged LEA to notify during the time or before the end of the school year, when you know that the school will not accept PI, this would allow the students to begin immediately at the start of the school year.
So in other words, you really shouldn't let the 14-day be a hindrance. If you know that you have a PI school that will not exit PI in 08-09 when the data is released, then you could notify now, or you could notify any time before maybe the end of the school year that about their transfer options, and those students can start right immediately in September.
We have a new question that just came in that relates to something that was just talked about. Do we plan on providing samples of letters in different languages, perhaps using our CDE system providing translations? Would you like to talk about that?
Yes, well, as you know, we currently do that. For the current notification letters that are on the website, we have them in multiple languages. So when we make changes to now meet the requirements of these new regulations, absolutely, we will be making those available in multiple languages as well.
So I'm going to take another question that came in your registration information. What does the LEA do if it receives more applications than it has spaces available for public school choice? Every student enrolled in a Title I school identified for program improvement, or PI, who wishes to transfer to another school that's not in PI must have that opportunity. If an LEA does not have sufficient capacity in its schools that are not identified for PI to accommodate the demand for transfers, the LEA must create additional capacity. An LEA may not use lack of capacity to deny students the option to transfer. However, an LEA may take capacity into consideration in deciding which schools to make available to eligible students.
I think we'll take maybe one more question that was submitted.
The fourth question, you know, related to public school choice submitted to us before the presentation, was what do we do if we do not have non-PI middle schools within the district and our neighboring district don't have any available spaces to take our students? The answer is, some LEAs may have no schools available to which students can transfer. This situation might occur when all schools at the grade level are identified for PI, or when an LEA has only a single school at that grade level. It may also occur in LEAs whose schools are so remote from each other that changing school is impractical. For example, if the only other elementary school or middle school in this case is 100 miles away, then changing schools is likely impracticable. In these cases, the LEA must, to the extent practical, enter into cooperative agreements with other LEAs in the area that can accept its students as transfers. The LEA may also wish to offer SES to students attending schools in their first year of program improvement who cannot be given the opportunity to change schools. If an LEA has contacted their neighboring district and they cannot accommodate students, then please keep on file your attempts and responses so that you can document what you did to meet the requirement in law.
Okay, I think let's go back now to the and continue with the presentation.
So we're ready for slide 14, where we're talking about the new regulation language about LEA posting expectations. The requirement that the LEA post information about choice in SES very prominently and in timely manner is well described in the regs as well as in the non-regulatory guidance. We're hoping all LEAs, of course, have their own website. Nonetheless, the state will work with you to ensure that we have information on the state website if you simply cannot do this. So we'll be expecting to hear from those districts that may have a problem. An LEA is encouraged to continue posting historical data even when there are no longer schools in PI. An LEA must display this data in a place that's easy for parents to locate and in a language that's easy for them to understand. In addition, the LEA must post the information about choice in SES in a timely manner to ensure that parents have current information on their options. However, as I mentioned, the State Department of Ed must post information on behalf of an LEA that does not have a website, so we'll be seeking input from you regarding that possible need. LEAs are expected to continue posting information about choice in SES on their websites every year that they have schools in PI. An LEA that no longer has any Title I schools and or is no longer able to offer SES because it has no available providers is encouraged to continue to display on its website historical data on student eligibility for and participation in SES from prior school years. Looking at slide 15, we're talking about more details about web posting for LEAs. The LEAs current school year needs to include a current list of non-PI schools to which eligible students can transfer. In addition, beginning with data from 2007-2008 school year and for each subsequent year, an LEA is required to post data on the number of students who were eligible for and who participated in choice and or SES. For choice, an LEA may also include information on the academic achievement of the schools from which parents may choose, as well as other information on these schools, such as any special programs, facilities, the availability of before and after school programs, the professional qualification of teachers, parent involvement opportunities, et cetera. The LEA should also include some information such as procedures and timelines that parents must follow in selecting a school for their child, how transportation will be paid for or provided. In addition, an LEA could include information obtained from the CDE's website on the LEA's 20% obligation for choice and SES. Please note that the CDE will also add the 20% obligation for choice in SES to the putting of the per pupil rate for SES in the future postings that we do in the fall of each year. Furthermore, an LEA may also include a link to the downloadable form for parents to use to request to transfer their child to another school. Finally, an LEA must continue posting historical data on choice and SES participation and eligibility and its current list of providers in subsequent school years accordingly. On slide 16, we continue the discussion of what has to be posted, and this slide is most specifically about SES, and I would like to note that one of our co-presenters, Becky Robinson, had suggested I look at the website for LAUSD regarding SES, and much of what's listed here, as well as what Niambi Clay mentioned in slide 10, is posted as examples on the LAUSD site. I'll give you the address in just a moment. An LEA's website must post a list of all SES providers approved to serve the LEA in the current year and the location where SES are provided. The location of services, such as the child's school, home, or community library, will also be available for LEAs to download at the CDE SES provider webpage. The webpage, of course, is named, and the address is given on slide 12. In addition, the website must also include information on which providers are able to serve students with disabilities or English learners, and may include other information such as the LEA's timeline, SES, and procedures for student enrollment to help parents make informed decisions about their SES options and the per pupil allocation and their per pupil allocation for SES. Furthermore, an LEA must post information on approved providers as early in the school year as possible so that parents can access this information when making decisions about their child's participation in SES. Update this information periodically throughout the year as updates become necessary. Finally, information on choice and SES must be updated as new information becomes available. These are all expectations of the new regulations passed in October 2000. Let's look at slide 17.
We have a polling activity. Kurt, can you take us through this?
We are going to get an idea of those LEAs that are and are not posting information. So this question is, does your LEA post information on choice and SES? If yes, what kind of information? So notice that you can check a number of the boxes on this submit form. The last one is if you do not post any information. So that's your no answer. Check all the other ones that you do post, and we're going to display this in just a second. We're still hearing some other noise from the phone lines, but if you're a presenter, please make sure that you're star six unless you're speaking. All right, we've got about 16 responses now. We're up to 29. We have about 73 people in the room, so that's about 40%. We'll give it another 15 seconds. So go ahead and check off the boxes of the things that you do post. Do you post a list of schools? You put the number of eligible students? Do you post it to the providers? Or the locations where SES are provided? All right, we have about 59% of our audience that's responded, and one more second, and then I'm going to publish those results. All right. So if you haven't done, press submit now, and I'm going to publish. All right, so I wonder if someone at CDE would like to talk about what they see here. CDE, did you want to comment? CDE, you must be...
Hi, Kurt. I'm sorry. We were having problems, technical problems.
Okay.
Back. Yes, I can see that 26% of those that are participating do make available of the list of available schools for choice. Let's see, the highest 56%. No, wait a minute. Oh, I see. 56% do not post information at all about SCS or choice. Okay, so we have a lot of work to do on that one, particularly since now we're requirements. So we'll be talking more to you about that. And I think later on we are going to ask you specifically where you need help. So that's good to know because that gives us a sense of the work that we have ahead of us.
Excellent. So let's go ahead and move on to slide 18.
Kurt, I think you're asking now for...
More questions.
Yes,
okay.
For participants to give us some questions on what you've just heard.
And I'm seeing some really good questions on the chat line. I'll try to capture them while we deal with some of the other questions that have come through. One that's really easy is from Eileen Shepherd. Are we now required to hold two provider fairs? And if so, what is the appropriate amount of time that should elapse between them for the two windows of registration for SCS?
Well, there's no requirement at all for provider fairs, that question, although it's good practice, and we know that a lot of districts do that. If you're talking about an enrollment window where you notify parents that they can now sign up for SCS, you're going to hear a little bit later in the presentation that that's a new requirement in the eggs, but specific to LEAs that don't spend the full 20% obligation for SCS and choice. But you'll be hearing more about that one.
We're going to go give you some answers to the questions submitted before the presentation. The first one that submitted to us was, how do we contact SCS providers to determine who's willing to serve our district? This is probably a very short answer. The answer is that each provider has a profile that includes which LEAs in California they are willing to serve. These profiles are posted at PDE's SCS website. They can be searched in the alphabetical order by county and the district name. LEAs can utilize contact information provided in the database for communication with these providers.
Another question came in. Can a provider invoice 2 hours of services when they provided 1 hour of services to two children in one family? And I guess that's, as an LEA, how an LEA pays a provider for services must be specified in the agreement contract with the provider. So that's something for you to deal with so that you're very clear on what you're paying for. I think another thing that you might look at is in the profile, the provider profile, they say what their hourly rate is, and is it for one-on-one tutoring or is it one-to-five tutoring? So you can go, as an LEA, you go there to see what they agree to do in their application in terms of services, so you can check this. And also you can deal with this in your contract with the provider so that you are very clear on what the rates are and what the payment requirement is.
One of the questions that came in on the chat line, Maria, relates to a question that was just answered a minute ago, and that is, are we required to list all the providers approved, or only those that have been have said that they would serve our district? Only those who have said they would serve your district. How do we address providing SCS to students with disabilities, especially those who are moderate to severe? LEAs that arrange for SCS must ensure that eligible students with disabilities who are eligible for services under IDEA and eligible students covered under Section 504 have an equal opportunity to participate in SCS and that they receive appropriate accommodations in the provisions of SCS. This is found within the regulations now. The State Department of Ed must indicate on our list of approved providers, and the LEAs must indicate on their list of parents that those providers that are able to serve students with disabilities, which is part of the application process. SES must be consistent with the student's individualized education program, IEP, under Section 614 of IDEA, or a student's individual services plan under Section 504. However, these services must be in addition to and not a substitute for the instruction and services required under the EA and Section 504 and should not be written into IEPs or plans. And LEA can help facilitate the participation in SES of a student with disabilities by providing a copy of the student's IEP, facilitating a discussion about it, or relevant portion of the IEP to the provider selected by the student's parents with the parent's written consent to do so.
You know, we should add that if there is no provider that is serving your LEA that says that they can serve students with disabilities or even each learners, then it is the district's responsibility to ensure, to either provide the service yourself directly, to look maybe for neighboring districts that have agreements with providers that could provide this also in your district and enter into contracts. Or a third party, you could also enter into a third party contract, but obviously you need to be able to have those services available in any of those ways.
One of the questions that's on the chat line is, should we choose not to work with, can we choose not to work with certain SES providers, or must we offer all providers as a choice to parents? Let's assume that this question is about only those that have asked to work with that particular LEA. Maria, how would you answer it?
You have to contact all those providers who said they want to serve your LEA. And ensure that, or if they say yes, want to work with you, then you must make information about that, about those providers available to your parents. If a parent chooses any one of those providers, then you have to contract with that peer. So it's really not the LEA who decides which providers you're going to contract with. It's really going to be the parent, because they're the ones that select the provider that is providing services within district.
There's some really good questions coming in on the chat line. We'll work with them as much as we can in the future. I don't know how our timeline is right now. Do we need to?
Let's take one more.
We'll take one more?
Yeah.
One of the questions that comes up is about sample contracts. Not only, of course, does the SES group have as a goal to produce some sample contract language, but this question is specific to the definition of tutoring. I know we've had many problems with some providers thinking that their job is homework assistance, which of course it isn't. But a clear definition of tutoring is being asked for as part of the contract language. So we'll make note of that question, and if you have some additional thoughts to add to the chat line regarding it, please offer, and we may come back to you with some more questions on how you would define tutoring.
Okay, as we move on to slide 19, I'll address one question that came in on the chat line too. Chuck asked, will this presentation be available in podcast or other format? Yes, this an archive of this presentation will be available, and we'll talk about that at the end of this presentation. So now we're going to move on to slide 19. And who's presenting here?
Jim and Modesto.
Well, thank you, Jim, and I'll put up our image, and let's move on. Thank you, Jim.
Oh, that's a good picture of me. Thank you. This one is about funding for choice and SES, or so-called set-asides. An LEA that has any schools in program improvement must set aside an amount equivalent or equal to 20% of its Title I Part A allocation and spend the equivalent of between 5 and 15% of its Title I Part A allocation on SES and on choice-related transportation. The precise amount for each program will be dependent on the relative demand for choice-related transportation and for SES, and also on whether the LEA chooses to spend up to 1% of its 20% obligation on parent outreach and assistance. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in two slides. The 20% set aside for choice in SES does include the portion from the Recovery Act or the stimulus, unless a waiver is approved and indicated by the U.S. Department of Education. At this point, the U.S. Department of Education has not published a procedure for such type of waiver. The CDE will notify LEAs as soon as it receives notices on how LEAs can apply for the waiver. And I don't think there is an update from the department regarding that at this time. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Jim.
Very good. Then we'll go forward to slide 20 on funding for choice continued. An LEA may limit the amount that it will make available for choice-related transportation in SES to less than its 20% obligation if it is able to provide SES or choice-related transportation to all eligible students using less than that amount. In that case, the LEA may immediately use for other allowable activities the difference between its 20% obligation and the amount needed to serve all eligible students. The LEA must consider student eligibility for choice in SES to be, number one, all students who attend a Title I program improvement year one school are eligible for choice, and two, all students from low-income families enrolled in a Title I program improvement year two school or above are eligible for SES. An LEA may not define student eligibility to be the one used for prioritizing students for services when funding is inadequate to serve all eligible students. And next, we move forward to slide 21, which is some new information in this guidance. These are the allowable charges for parent outreach and assistance. What is new in funding for choice in SES is the provision in the new Title I regulation that allows LEAs to count up 2% of their parent outreach and assistance activities against the 20% obligation. Though an LEA can determine the most effective means of providing outreach and assistance to parents of eligible students, it should use the flexibility to use these funds to provide support and information to parents about the availability of choice in SES. For example, an LEA can use funds to pay for the cost of parent notification letters, communication to parents through the media or internet, community partners, displaying information on an LEA's website, and provider fares held by the LEA. The cost of these activities counts towards the 20% obligation. On the other hand, an LEA may not count toward its 20% obligation the administrative costs such as contracting with or arranging for payment to SES providers or costs associated with matching students to respective providers. Such administrative costs may be allowable Title I expenditures, but may not be counted toward meeting an LEA's 20% obligation. Only when an LEA has unspent funds from the 1% cap in the first year and did not fulfill the new reallocation requirements, which we'll be talking about in the next few slides, is it then allowed to add the unspent funds from the 1% for parent reach and assistance in the subsequent school year.
Jim, I'm going to continue with the funding for SES and choice, which are also the new requirements in the Title I regulations. In order for a LEA to reallocate unspent funds from the 20% obligation, the LEA must meet certain criteria specified in the Title I regulations. The new reallocation requirements for the 20% obligation kick in for the 2009-2010 Title I allocation. LEAs will utilize the 2010-2011 CONAP Part 1 to report on whether or not meeting these requirements. To give LEAs some advance notice and practice, the CDE added these new requirements in the 2009-2010 CONAP Part 1. Although there will be no compliance consequences for the funds allocated in 2008-2009. Let's go on to the next slide, 28. The first area of requirements for reallocation is to partner with outside groups to inform students and parents of SES and the choice. What does it mean to partner with outside groups? Does the LEA need to form a formal partnership in order to meet the criterion that it partners with outside groups? The answer is no. The criterion that LEA partners with outside groups should not be significantly burdensome or costly for LEA, and no formal agreement is needed. Partnering with the outside group should be a cost-effective way for LEA to promote SDS with partner groups such as faith-based organizations, community-based organizations, and business groups already have a presence in the community and therefore give the LEA a way to tap into existing resources with little additional effort or cost. For instance, the LEA could ask a partner to post out literature on SDS, make announcements about the LEA's upcoming SDS events and timelines, or help with the LEA write parent-friendly letters. A partner group could assist an LEA with parent outreach with respect to either SDS or choice, or could assist with communicating to parents on both options. An LEA should make a good faith effort to partner with a outside group or groups, which should include attempts to reach several groups in the community that have connections to families of eligible students. If an LEA cannot form a partnership with the outside group, it should maintain records documenting these reasons why. We offer a note of caution here. That is, partnering organizations as well as LEAs should only provide unbiased and objective information on choice and SDS, and may not promote any particular SDS providers. Slide 24 is the second area of the reallocation requirements, which is about providing a genuine opportunity for students and parents to sign up for choice and SDS. How does the LEA provide timely, accurate notice to parents regarding choice and SDS? To meet the criterion that LEA does that, and the LEA must provide notice regarding choice and SDS directly through such means as regular mail or email, or through broader means of dissemination, such as the internet, the media, and the public agencies serving the student population and their families. An LEA should make its SDS sign-up accessible to parents and should distribute the form. For example, an LEA could post the form. An LEA could post the form on its website and mail the form home to parents, as well as leaving copies of the form at the school that have students eligible for SDS, or at the district offices, or at sites where parents may go, such as libraries or community centers. In addition, an LEA should not restrict the distribution of sign-up forms, including photocopying of the form, by individuals and organizations outside the LEA. Finally, an LEA should ensure that they have an open, reasonable, and convenient process for parents to return the completed sign-up form. How can a LEA meet the criterion that it offers at least two SDS enrollment windows of sufficient length and at separate points in the school year? The sufficient length criterion means that parents should have a reasonable amount of time to obtain information about providers serving their area, consider their options, and sign up for SDS. It also means enrollment windows must be sufficiently convenient for parents, particularly for working parents and single parents. For example, enrollment periods limit to 2 hours a day after school for 2 or 3 days a week would not be deemed of sufficient length to give working parents a genuine opportunity to sign up. The U.S. Department of Education has advised or has recommended that a period of at least 2 weeks to be a sufficient. How does the LEA meet the requirement or the criterion to provide at least two enrollment windows at separate points in the school year? We talked a little bit on this issue, but let me give you a little bit more information on this. This would mean, for example, the LEA might allow students to enroll in SDS during the early fall, coinciding with the start of the school and holding a second enrollment window later in late fall or early winter after waiting period has ended. You can see that the LEA has flexibilities as to at what time of the year they offer the second window for sign-up. Well, the next few slides, we're going to talk about these requirements. The third area, the third criterion for meeting the reallocation requirements is about ensuring SS providers are given a fair, open, and objective process for the use of school facilities. In other words, an LEA that spends less than the 20% obligation and wishes to use the unexpended amount for other allowable activities must give SS providers access to school facilities in the same manner and on the same basis as it gives access to other outside groups. The CDE encourages an LEA to develop a facilities policy that is public and easily understood by providers and parents. An LEA with many eligible students and schools may need to implement a different policy than the one with few eligible students due to capacity limitations. You are probably aware that the existing state law under the Civic Center Act requires LEA to establish equitable and fair procedures which allow community nonprofit groups to use school facilities. However, you probably are aware that most SS providers are not nonprofit organizations. They are mostly profit organizations. Therefore, this Civic Center Act does not up to them. So that's why we are strongly encouraging, CDE strongly encourages LEA to develop a policy that includes everybody. So the next few slides, we're going to continue to talk about when these requirements do not apply. Becky, would you take us through that?
Yes. And all of these requirements that Lana just discussed apply to districts except in certain circumstances. And there may be circumstances in which an LEA does not spend its full 20% obligation, yet is not subject to the reallocation criteria. The first such circumstance is when an LEA is not able to provide public school choice because it has only one school at each grade level and cannot provide SES because it is not served by any providers, including online providers. On slide 27, we continue. The LEA does not need to meet the reallocation criteria, reallocating unspent funds, if it enrolls sufficient numbers of eligible students to spend all funds reserved for choice and SES, but it still has funds left over at the end of the year because one or more providers did not fulfill their contractual obligations or because enrolled students did not begin or complete services, which means if the LEA encumbered all of its money in contracts with providers, but at the end of the year the money was not spent, the LEA does not have to go through the requirements for the criteria above. However, if an LEA experiences significant student attrition in its SES program early in the school year, leading to lower than anticipated expenditures, the LEA should consider holding a second or third or fourth enrollment period and sign up a sufficient number of students to use its full 20% obligations. And again on slide 28, in the case of an LEA that is able to provide choice and or SES to all eligible students without spending its full 20% obligation, the reallocation criteria would apply to the LEA only with respect to the amount of funds that is needed to serve all eligible students. The LEA would be permitted to use the difference between the 20% obligation and the needed amount immediately for other allowable activities. For example, if an LEA could provide choice-related transportation and or SS to all eligible students with an amount equal to 10% of its Title I Part A allocation, it would be required to reserve only that amount and would be able to use the other half of its 20% obligation immediately for other allowable activities. If an LEA spends less than the amount equal to 10% of its Title I Part A allocation, the LEA would need to meet the criteria in order to reallocate funds. Otherwise, carry over the unspent amount in the subsequent school year. Note that an LEA seeking to use a portion of its 20% obligation immediately for other allowable activities must base the amount it reserves for choice and SES on all eligible students who choose to transfer to a non-PI school or obtain SES, not on a prioritized list of students. And Lana is going to review the implementation timelines in the next few slides. Lana?
Yes, Becky. I'm going to take everybody through slide 29, implementation timelines. Well, we already talked about the 40-day notice for choice, which in California would not be able to implement yet, or seeking a waiver. The next one is the timeline for new parental provisions notice. That begins with the 09-10 parent notification, which is, you know, coming up in the summer. The third piece, LEA's web posting of choice and SES data, that is as soon as possible so that parents will be able to benefit from the information posted on the website. The fourth piece is CDE's posting of LEA's data on CDE's website will also have to be, as soon as possible, before the start of the next school year, 09-10. But however, we do need LEAs to let us know that whether or not, if you are not able to do the web posting of these information.
Lana, I think this also refers to, there are requirements for the SEA to post certain information because you as LEAs are going to need to use it in your notification. So we will be posting the information such as not just the per pupil, but the total amount that is available for the 20% obligation and a few other things.
That's correct, Maria. Thank you. The last piece is 20% obligation and the reallocation requirements for 20% obligation. That will kick in for the 09-10 school year. However, the reporting on that will be in, as I said earlier, in CONAP Part 1 of 010-11. So let's move on to the next slide, which is a polling exercise. Could you help us with that?
I certainly will, Lana. So again, we're at a poll. This information for everyone to see how pans out with our assembled group. What areas do you most need assistance in meeting the new requirements? Please check all those applicable. So you've been asking some questions along the way. We saw that 26 folks assembled here today, nearly our largest group responding to the poll, so they weren't posting. So let us know what you need help with. This will help us with future webinars, and we do have a group of folks that are SES coordinators working with CDE, developing tools and resources for use throughout the state. So about 19 people responding, that's 26% of our audience. Please go ahead and choose any and all of those that you need help with, and we'll post the results. So 15 more seconds. And if you haven't pressed submit, do so right now, and I'm going to publish. So, it looks CDE, would you like to interpret the results?
Yes, okay, again, this is going to indicate the work we have ahead of us. I see that you're indicating that you need help with partnering with outside groups, 56%. And the next area where you most need help is the fair, open, and objective process for use of school facilities. That was 43%, and 30% are you're saying you need help with a timely, accurate notice to parents. So I guess those are the top three areas that we can certainly talk to you about as we continue in this discussion. I want to point out that this is the first time we're going to be talking to you about this, but not the last. We intend to send written memo out to you about this so that you have something in writing as well, but at least this gives us a chance also to hear some of your concerns so we can address that also.
All right, we're going to move on to another question and answer period. Just before we can begin, I did see some questions come in, one regarding the questions that have been assembled. Yes, there will be an FAQ developed, and it will be posted at the same site as the archive of this event. So let's address any other questions that we can at this time.
We have a question that's a off topic. I'd like to simply state out loud and see whether or not we can deal with it, to see if anything about the funding, the special stimulus money. I need to see that question again.
Judy, actually, we do have the answer for that question. There was a similar question submitted before mm-hmm. presentation. Maria,
oh,
would you take us through that question? In fund-related
funding? The first
funding?
One?
Yeah.
Okay, a question was submitted that said, what are the guidelines for all set-asides, not just those limited to choice and SES, that are related to the additional stimulus, in other words, Title ARA funds? The same rules for Title I Part A reservations apply to the additional Title I ARA funds, including the set-asides for choice and SES. The U.S. Department of Education will shortly release the waiver process to be followed in order for LEAs to waive these required reservations. I think we're maybe about 4 weeks away from the feds making available that waiver process. In addition to the 20% obligation for choice and SES that can be waived, the other waiver set-asides that you can waive are the 10% professional development, the SES pupil rate, maintenance of effort, and carryover. But again, at this point, we haven't heard from the Fed yet regarding what the process is going to look like. We do know that it will be waiver from the LEA to the U.S. Department of Education. They're going to give us more specifics. I think they're talking about the SEA, meaning the California Department of Education, possibly bundling those waivers and taking a first cut at review and then forwarding them to the U.S. Department of Education.
Can I see some of the questions? There were
Maria, actually there's one related to the facility use policy. Let me just say that the requirement facility use policy that will apply to SS providers may kick in when a LEA has unspent funds from the 20% obligation. We will, if you, the person who your district is responsible for CONAP, we have instructions, specific instructions on how when that requirement will kick in the instruction for that particular page. That would be page 25 in CONAP 1.
Although, I must add, though, that this is a sensitive issue. We hear a lot from providers about this issue, about getting access to facilities, and we strongly recommend that you have a policy that applies to anyone that wants access to your facilities and that you can feel certain that it's fair and equitable to all those that are asking you to use your school facilities.
One of the questions had to do with the timing of the per pupil amounts. And it would be wonderful if that data were available in August as the questioner requested, but it's not going to happen because we don't have all the calculations of the student attendance by then in order to for the department to fully calculate and publish, but we will continue to ask for the information as soon as possible.
Actually, the CDE, the reason the CDE is not able to publish the rate early is also because some county office of education or charter schools may have not submitted or confirmed whether or not they were receiving Title I funds. That's why the funding level of each LEA fluctuates. Due to that reason, until we know that every LEA who is eligible for Title I funds confirms whether or not they will receive them, the CDE able to calculate the per pupil rate.
Although, I must say we're going to do our best to try to get you that information. We understand that you need it, and we have for the last couple of years improved on that date, maybe not to where you want it to be yet, but we have improved it for the last 2 years. We've been moving it up earlier, and we will continue to talk with our fiscal partners in the department to continue to move that up earlier and earlier so you have that information. We realize that you need it.
there were a couple of questions about limiting how many providers a district has to work with. Number one is the state board has to approve the provider. In the process of approving, the provider indicates which districts they'd like to work with. That district notation requires that you, the district, work with those providers. The only way to suggest that numbers might be fewer than that is if a provider does not agree to sign your contract, to meet requirements of liability insurance or something along that line, but you must work with all providers that indicated your district on their application.
I think Ken Scott is making a good comment here, saying that the per pupil should be based on prior year P2 and Title I allocation. And you know, Ken, that makes sense to us, but that's not the way the feds do it. They calculate it on the current Title I allocation. So unfortunately, that's not going to happen. Let's see.
Another clarification has to do with the carryover.
Yes, if you have not met the 6 criterion specified in the new Title I regulations, then you have to carry over any unspent funds from the 20% obligation to the following year to add to the following year's 20% obligation.
Therefore, this starts next year.
Yes.
One of the questions is, how long should each sign-up period last? The feds in the guidance have sort of weighed in on that, or I think one of their letters that they communicated recently, and they're saying that the sign-up period should at least be 2 weeks long to give parents, either for choice in SES, to give parents sufficient time to consider their options and to make a good decision. So feds are saying at least 2 weeks. There's a question about, we have 2 schools considered provisionary, meaning they're school-wide schools for free lunch, and that means that every child in the school is eligible for free lunch. And this is an option, as you know, that you have when you have such high concentrations of poor children enrolled in the school. So the question is, in this case, we cannot see what students actually qualify. Do we consider all of these students as eligible for SES services? The answer is yes. There's guidance on it. If you go to the link that we gave you for the SES and choice guidance, the feds have said if you're a provisionary school that all students are eligible for SES. As you know, it's low-income students for SES and usually it's a certain percentage, but for a provisionary, all students would be considered to be eligible.
I just want to clarify one issue. When we said that the carryover requirement, if you do not meet those reallocation criterion, we kick in for the 2009-10 funding, not for the 2008-09 funding. However, you have to think about meeting those criteria in the coming year, starting beginning in 2008-09. Those activities actually will need to be kick in as soon as possible. Otherwise, by towards the end of next year, which means in the second semester, if you try to say, oh, you know, we have funds left over, we have to meet those 6 criteria. Oh, it's too late. So that's why we provided you that information in CONAP Part 1 of 2010-11, which 2009-10, which captures, which actually, you know, talks about the activities in 2008-09. As an exercise, for information only, no compliance consequence for that. However, in the 2010-11 CONAP Part 1, when we ask you whether or not you have met those 6 criteria, there will be compliance consequences. So the key piece here is the requirement is tied to 2009-2010 Title I funding.
Thank you. I'm sorry I made that mistake.
There's a question about, can we refuse to work with the provider if in the past they have been late with their obligations? You know, this is when your contract with the providers really is important, where you as the LEA lay out the timelines that you expect from them in terms of services to students or submitting invoices to you, whatever it is that you think is important to
have a smooth running SES program. So put it in your contract is what I'm saying, so that if they don't meet those timelines, you do have right then to enforce that contract and possibly not work with that provider or discontinue working with that provider for that year.
Okay.
There's lots of other questions. Let's see.
Let's take two more, and then we do know that we're going to be posting an FAQ.
Here's a good one. Can the information in forms be sent home with students? In fact, it can. There was a letter from the secretary on this issue that said, actually it was the director of the office, of the Title I office, that said, because the law specify, you know, that you have to mail it or that it you have options of emailing the form or the notification, you can mail it, you can post it on the web. I mean, there's all different ways of informing parents, but the critical piece is if you send it home in the backpack of a child, for example, or if you give it to a child to take home for the parent to see, you really need to be concerned about documenting in some way that the student that the parent received the form. Obviously, when you mail it, you have evidence that you mailed, but if you choose to send it home in a backpack or give it to a child, strongly recommend that you institute something like having the parent sign that they received it, just to cover yourself so that you can, in fact, verify that that you fairly informed the parent and can be assured that they got that notification.
The other question I would like to address is that Katie says we have two schools who are considered provisionary, meaning school-wide free lunch. In this case, we cannot see what students actually qualify. Do we consider all of these students are eligible for SES services? The answer is a big yes. Another question that came in earlier was the issue of establishing the data about SES and choice on the LEA website. Would that cost having someone set up that data and manage it and keep it up to date be reasonable as an allowable parent outreach cost using that nuance of 0.2% of the 20% set aside? And the answer is yes.
I think if you, we're going to be posting the narrative also for this webinar, and I think that was one of the examples that were given as being an allowable cost that can that you can charge to the 1%.
In fact, you may be surprised how many of the questions have been answered within the narrative.
All right, so then we're going to go ahead and move on to, we do have some upcoming webinars, so Maria, did you want to talk about these?
Yes. Want to make sure that you calendar these. On June 18th, we're going to be doing a webinar on Title I school planning that works. And hopefully we'll also, June 19th, we will be doing a webinar on Title I school planning that works. With more than likely, we'd like to repeat that in the fall. We know that it's a little bit late because you've probably already done your planning right now. But certainly in the fall, most districts go back and take, once you know what your allocations are, you go back and take another look at these plans. So we're hoping that you can use this information to plan for that, but with the idea that we will repeat it again in the fall. We're also doing, on June 24th, a webinar for SES providers. As you know, they annually have to submit to us an accountability report where they provide all sorts of information to us, including data on pre and post test data on the services that they provided and whether it was it contributed to improving student achievement. So we're doing one for providers and walking them through that accountability report and everything that they need to give to us so that they understand the process. It's an online report, so we'll be taking it step by step through that. Also on June 24th, we are planning a SES 101 session for SES coordinators in districts or anyone that is responsible for implementing SES. This is where the wonderful work of the SES work group will really play a key role. Some of the work that we're doing with them is creating templates that we hope you find very useful for the student learning plan, for a contract that you can do with providers, and other key areas of implementing SES. So again, our LEA partners will be joining us, and we'll be giving you specific examples of templates that you can use. So please put that on your calendar. We look forward to participating with you on these sessions.
I would just clarify, I think that the SES 101 is going to be in the AM.
Yes.
And the SES online accountability report for providers will be in the PM, so afternoon.
Yes, the morning is for the LEA administrators, the afternoon is for the SES providers. Thank you, Kurt. And we will have registration at the same place that you all have registered for this particular webinar today.
Okay, I think we have one more question that we wanted to answer.
The question is, can a LEA carry over 20% of the unspent assets choice allocation to the following year, which means it might go over the 15% limit? You all aware that Title I funds, you cannot carry over 15% of Title I funds to the following year without ever approved by CDE. And you all understand that probably you can only apply for get a waiver once every 3 years. So therefore, you are strongly encouraged to spend the 20% obligation on choice in the SCS as much as possible.
Okay, and just to answer Eileen's question, is the May 27th SES webinar no longer planned? That's correct.
Eileen, we are asking for a little bit more time from the May 27th in order to increase the chances that we have some more samples to share with you that the SES work group is working to produce. Thank you for understanding, and please know that all of the webinars we are scheduling will be archived so that those of you who may already be on vacation can come back and listen to it later.
Okay, then I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. I want to thank our partners from the California Comprehensive Center. I especially want to thank Teresa Maldonado and Kurt Larson, who are sort of the technology experts behind the scene who make this happen. We couldn't do it without them. I also want to thank our partners with the SES Work Group. It's a pleasure to work with LEA partners, and we're learning a lot, and I hope that you will soon see the product of that collaboration in some of the upcoming webinars. Please send any inquiries that you have regarding this presentation to ses@cde.ca.gov. You see it on the screen right now in slide 33. Or call us about any questions that you might have that were triggered maybe by this discussion that we had. And again, the two websites I think that are very critical are listed on the slide as well. The website at the California Department of Education, as well as the one at the California Comprehensive Center. I want to note that that website is a brand new website that, again, we established with the help and collaboration of the SES Work Group, our LEA partners.
All right, and before you go, ladies and gentlemen, I'm now pushing a survey. This will give us an idea of how we're doing with the webinars, and also, is it meeting your needs in regard to the information? So please quickly fill out that. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. This is Kurt Larson from the California Comprehensive Center. And on behalf of the center, thank you for joining us and have a great day.
Our hang-up is now enabled.
Do we want to debrief?